Ephesians chapter 4 verses 4 through 10. The 11th talk in a series on Ephesians was presented by Jack Crabtree on June 17, 2018 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Jack Crabtree and is being made available to you by Gutenberg College. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. Contributions to Jack Crabtree may be made at www.soundinterp.wordpress.com. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. Handout number 9, translation, installment 7, accompanies this talk.
Okay, we're in Ephesians. If you got the handout sent to you, it duplicates, it goes back and duplicates a couple of paragraphs or so. I went back because I wanted to comment on paragraph 15, sentence 4, right at the bottom of page 5 in the new handout. Logan asked about this last week, and I got to looking at it a little bit more carefully and more thoroughly, and I changed my mind exactly how to take the syntax. I won't get into the technicalities, but what I would prefer as a translation right now is that you might be complete with respect to all that is contained in the fullness of the grace of God. In other words, the fullness of what God has in store for the elect, for those people who belong to Him, He's praying that you might be complete with respect to all that's contained in that fullness. I think that's probably the best way to take it. It then summarizes the first two requests. The first one in sentence 2 is that God would work in your heart to qualify you, basically, by bringing you to belief in the Messiah. Then the second one in verse 3, in sentence 3, is that you would one day experience everything that God has in store for you. And then to sum all of that up is that you might be completely qualified and completely immersed in everything that God has in store for you in His grace. So that's where I landed on that. But we are beginning today all the way on page 7 there. This is paragraph 17, chapter 4, verse 1, if you're in your normal Bible. We looked at the first part of that paragraph last week. Therefore, I urge you, I, the prisoner, because of the Lord, to walk in a manner suited to the calling to which you have been called, with all lowliness of mind and lack of presumption, with long suffering, putting up with one another out of love, strive earnestly to preserve the oneness which is from the Spirit, based on the mutual bond of peace. We already looked at that, but basically what he's saying is, we need to conduct our lives in such a way that's consistent with what it is that we have been appointed to. And what have we been appointed to? We've been appointed to this group of people, variously called the pleroma, the fullness, the whole, the church, the body. He has umpteen different words he uses for it. But we've been appointed to this group, and we all have exactly the same status and exactly the same standing in relationship to God if we are all members of this group. So we ought to treat each other accordingly, he's saying. We shouldn't ever think of ourselves, we shouldn't disrespect another member of this same group, of the elect, of the body. So we looked at that last week. I want to finish that paragraph, and then we enter into the next three paragraphs are perhaps the most exegetically most challenging part of Ephesians. So push back on me here. I think I understand it, but who knows? But let's finish verse 17 first. He's still talking about the oneness that we have. Remember, this oneness that we have is an objective oneness. It's something that the Spirit of God has created. It's not something that we create. It's something God has created. Well, what does it consist of? There is one body and one spirit, in as much as indeed you were called to one hope of your calling. I'm going to argue that we have a triplet here, and I've divided it by sentences. The first one is sentence 3, the second one is sentence 4, and the third one is sentence 5. So the first one, there is one body and one spirit, inasmuch as indeed you were called to one hope of your calling. We all have the same hope, basically, is what he's saying here. The one body is this collection, this group of people who have this hope. The spirit is the one who has worked the miracle in our inner beings to qualify us to meet the condition that puts us in that group that has that hope. And I think the main idea of that sentence is we have one and the same hope. So the destiny that awaits me is identical with everyone else in this body of the Messiah. So we have one hope. The second thing is we have one and the same relationship to Jesus. So there is one Lord, and there I think he's talking about the Messiah, Jesus. There is one Lord, one belief, and what's that belief that unites us? My belief that Jesus is the Messiah. There's one Lord, one belief in that Messiah, and one baptism. What is the baptism? The baptism is the initiation rite that we undergo when we make a decision to be disciples of Jesus. So all of us are fellow disciples of Jesus who confess Jesus as the Messiah in the one belief that unites us and make Jesus mutually our Lord. That's the fourth sentence. And then the fifth one is the common relationship to God that we all have if we belong to this group. There is one God and Father of all, he who is over all and to all and for all. And very simply, God and the Father of all. Here he's using Father in the sense as a kind of substitute for Creator. He's the origin of all things. And as the origin of all things, we bear a dependence relationship on him. He's our benefactor. He provides for us. Well, there's just one God and Father of all. He who is God over all, God to all, and God for all. Overall is stressing his authority and his sovereignty over all. The all here, although it would be all people, notice this whole paragraph is focused on the oneness that we all have who belong to this one body. So the all that he really is focused on is the all of us who belong to the body of Christ. Well, with respect to all of us, he has authority and sovereignty over every one of us. He is God to us in relationship to us. That is, he is our God and we are his people. So it's hearkening back to the very beginnings of this whole thing where he came to Abraham, said, I'm going to make you a great nation. I will be their God and they will be my people. So God has made a covenant with Abraham that he would be a God to them. No one else is going to be a God to them. He is going to be a God to them. Right? So he is the one we worship. He is the one we serve. He is the one we relate to. He is the one who gives us our identity. He is the one that we connect to. So he is our God, all of us. And for all, that is, we are the ones who benefit from him being our God. His purpose is to provide for us and to advantage us in many different ways. Gives us many gifts. So he's just rounding off and finishing the point of this paragraph that we have, that there's a oneness that binds us all together. But in the context of his argument, what's the purpose for underlining that? Because it's a question of how should we live? And what he's saying is, how should we live? Well, one thing is for sure, We need to live in such a way that we respect the oneness that we have with everyone else in the body. I'll just call it the body to keep things simple. Okay. Now the next paragraph starts a new section, I think. For years I read this thing, and you know, you come across verse 7 and you go, where on earth is this coming from? What on earth are you talking about? This has nothing to do with anything that you have been talking about. So what's going on here? The only way we can, just a heads up, what he's going to go on to do in this next section is to say, this group, this body, what is this body? Who are we? How should we think of ourselves? How should we understand who we are? We are a group of war captives who've been taken captive and are being given by the Messiah to God to be slaves who serve God, basically. That's the project that God is engaged in. The project that God is engaged in is to amass a group of people who will serve him. And who is instrumental in bringing that about and forming that group? The Messiah. It's the Messiah who's taken captive and taken those captives and given them as gifts to God that they might serve him. But there's no way in the world that we would understand that without understanding Psalm 68. So I'm going to take a little detour here to Psalm 68. There's as much about Psalm 68 that I don't understand as there is that I do understand, but I think I understand enough to understand what Paul is doing with it. I think what as I would understand it, it divides up into seven sections, and so I'm going to take them a section at a time and just briefly comment on it. It's in the fourth section is the passage that Paul quotes here in Ephesians. But I'll try to orient you to what I think is going on as we go. This is a particularly difficult psalm for me to understand because it's not obviously coherent. It's not obvious that there's a unity to it or a pattern to it. In fact, I read some commentators who basically gave up and said they don't think there is one. But I don't think that's right. I think there is one. I just don't think I'm smart enough to figure it out yet. But let me do the best I can. The first three verses form the first part, and I think what he's saying in the first part, you can follow along in your normal Bibles if you have access to one. Psalm 68, verse 1. I'm reading from the New English Translation here. I've made some very slight modifications in a couple of places. God springs into action. His enemies scatter. His adversaries run from him. As smoke is driven away by the wind, so you drive them away. As wax melts before fire, so the wicked are destroyed before God. But the godly are happy. They rejoice before God and are overcome with joy. This sets the theme, I think, for the entire psalm, that he's describing the power of God to destroy his enemies. And his enemies being also the enemies of Israel. This is talking about, he just announces the power of God to go up against his enemies and strike fear in them and destroy them. So that's kind of a thesis statement for the psalm. Then he has a second part, and the second part, we see it describing God as one who protects and provides for the underdog. I don't know if this is right, but I think he's using Israel itself and their history as the example of the underdog that he protects and provides for. I think there are very subtle, but nonetheless, some allusions to the Exodus account here. I may be wrong, but I think that must be what he has in mind. So starting with verse 4, sing to God, sing praises to his name, exalt the one who rides on the clouds, for the Lord, or Yahweh, is his name. Rejoice before him. He is a father to the fatherless and an advocate for widows. God rules from his holy palace. God settles those who have been deserted in their own homes. He frees prisoners and grants them prosperity, but sinful rebels live in the desert. Okay, so this is God's focus on taking the underdog, the one who is in need, the orphan, the widow, the ones who are homeless, and coming along and blessing them, offering protection to them. Then we start part three. Part three is very similar to something that gets said in what's called the Song of Deborah. Deborah, you know, was the very first, I believe, judge in Israel, the woman prophetess who led them to victory. And after her big victory against when, what's the guy's name, had a tent peg pounded through his head, when he was destroyed, they were celebrating the victory, and they created this thing called the Song of Deborah, and that you can find that in the Judges, I believe. Well, a lot of the language here is very reminiscent of that. So I think what this is intended to do is to remind us that God led the people of Israel in victory in the time of Deborah, but there are many allusions to Sinai here. So it's the God of Sinai who led the people of Israel in victory. And I'll explain the importance of that in a second. So in 68 verse 7, O God, when you lead your people into battle, when you march through the desert, the earth shakes. Yes, the heavens pour down rain before God, the God of Sinai, before God, the God of Israel. O God, you cause abundant showers to fall on your chosen people. When they are tired, you sustain them. For you live among them. You sustain the oppressed with your good blessings, O God. The Lord speaks. Many, many women spread the good news. Kings leading armies run away. They run away. The lovely lady of the house divides up the loot. I think this is the women announcing the victory of the kings out in battle. When you lie down among the sheepfolds, the wing of the dove are covered with silver and with glittering gold. Don't have a clue. When the sovereign judges scatters kings, let it snow on Salmon. But I think what the basic import of this in the psalm is to identify the God who led Israel into battle and victorious in battle is the same as the God of Mount Sinai. So that it's that identification I think that's important. Then we get to part four, and this is the one that he quotes. He's doing three things here. He's identifying the irony that of all the places for God to choose to establish his dwelling place, it would be Mount Zion and not what he calls the Mountain of Bashan, but I think that's Mount Hermon. Mount Hermon is about a 10,000 foot high mountain in north upper Galilee. It's an actual mountain that even Oregonians would call a mountain. Zion is a hill. it's in the higher lands, but it's a hill. It's a bump in the higher lands. So it's ironic that God would choose as his dwelling place Mount Zion rather than Mount Hermon. So that's one of the points he makes. Then he talks about the Lord coming from Sinai in holy splendor. But we're talking about Mount Zion in this part of the psalm. So I think this is an allusion to the bringing of the ark to Mount Sinai to be the place where God is, where God dwells. But what God is going to take up residence on Mount Sinai? Mount Zion? Did I say Sinai all along? Who's taking up residence on Mount Zion? The God of Mount Sinai. So it's represented as a kind of procession with his many chariots traveling as God travels from Mount Sinai to Mount Zion to take up residence. And then you have the part that he quotes. Let me read it all and then I'll comment on that. The mountain of Bashan is a towering mountain. The mountain of Bashan is a mountain with many peaks. Why do you look with envy, O mountains with many peaks, at the mountain where God has decided to live? Indeed, the Lord will live there permanently. God has countless chariots. They number in the thousands. The Lord comes from Sinai in holy splendor. Then he says, you ascend on high. You have taken the captives captive. You take gifts consisting of men, including even sinful rebels, so that the blessed God Yahweh might dwell there. Let me skip over that for now. We'll come back to that. Now he goes on to another part with an acknowledgement again that Yahweh delivers Israel from its enemies. Yeah. The Lord deserves praise. Day after day, he carries our burden, the God who delivers us. Our God is a God who delivers. Yahweh, the sovereign Lord, can rescue from death. Indeed, God strikes the heads of his enemies, the hairy foreheads of those who persist in rebellion. The Lord says, I will retrieve them from Bashan. I will bring them back from the depths of the sea so that your feet may stomp in their blood and your dogs may eat their portion of the enemy's corpses. So God is fully capable of defeating and destroying the enemies of Israel. Then we have part six where we shift, and something I haven't mentioned yet, inscription on this psalm is it's a psalm to David. And I think it is a psalm to David. And we see that here in part six. And I think what's being described here is a procession of the ark to Mount Zion, probably from, where is that place where it had been? It had been housed somewhere closer to the coast, and they brought it. Remember the story where it was started to rock and fall, and Uriah pushed it to keep it from falling and was killed, and David was really ticked that God killed him. That's that procession where the ark is being moved to Zion. So I think that's what's being described here. They see your processions, O God, the processions of my God, my King, who marches along in holy splendor. Okay, I would argue that the God there is David, or the Messianic King, the Davidic King. They see your processions, O God, the processions of my God, my King, who marches along in holy splendor. Singers walk in front, musicians follow, playing their stringed instruments in the midst of young women playing tambourines. In your large assemblies, praise God, Yahweh, in the assemblies of Israel. There is little Benjamin, their ruler, and the princes of Judah in their robes, along with the princes of Zebulun and the princes of Naphtali. O God has decreed that you, David, I think, will be powerful. O God, you have acted on our behalf. Demonstrate your power. As you come out, now he's talking about Yahweh, I think. As you come out of your temple in Jerusalem, kings bring tribute to you. Sound your battle cry, not sure, maybe David at that point. Sound your battle cry against the wild beast of the reeds and the nations that assemble like a herd of calves led by bulls. They humble themselves and offer gold and silver as tribute. God scatters the nations that like to do battle. They come with red cloth from Egypt. Ethiopia voluntarily offers tribute to God. So all of that is about this moving of God, the God of Mount Sinai, to Mount Zion on the one hand, but it's also reminding us of the covenant that God made with David and the power that God is going to has delegated to David. And then the psalm ends. It's a message to the kings of the earth to praise Yahweh. O kingdoms of the earth, sing to God, sing praises to the Lord, to the one who rides through the sky from ancient times. Look, he thunders loudly. Acknowledge God's power, his sovereignty over Israel, and the power he reveals in the skies. You are awe-inspiring, O God, as you emerge from your holy temple. It is the God of Israel who gives the power, the people power and strength. God deserves praise. Okay, returning then to 68:18, the one that's quoted. Remember, Mount Hermon, don't get jealous of Mount Zion. God is bringing his residents from Mount Sinai to Mount Zion. And then he says, you ascend on high. You have taken the captives captive. You take gifts consisting of men. It's not you give gifts to men, as many English translations have it. You take gifts consisting of men, including even sinful rebels, so that the blessed God, Yahweh, might dwell there. Okay, this is kind of cryptic. The you is David, or the Davidic king in any case, but I would say it's David, it's the Messiah. He ascends on high. You have taken the captives captive. Well, where has he been? Well, to ascend on high is a way of describing going back up to Jerusalem, back up to Mount Zion. So ascending on high is going up to the temple, basically. He's taking up to the temple captives. You have taken captives captive. You take gifts consisting of men. Those captives that you've taken in battle, you're leading them in a triumphal march. You're leading them up to Jerusalem, and you're going to give them to God to serve in the temple. Those men that you're giving him include even sinful rebels. And why are you giving God gifts? So that the blessed God Yahweh might dwell there. That is, so that his temple there can function. Now, what we have to recognize here is that, let me read a portion here. It was not uncommon to take captives in battle, and those captives would then be taken back to your city-state, and the captives would be made slaves who would serve your God in your God's temple. And the kind of service that they would give would be the more menial kinds of things around, you know, they're not here in this case, they're not Levites, so they can't do the chores of the Levites, but there are other things that they can do to make the functioning of the temple possible. According to the Bible Encyclopedia I was looking at, there in Ezra, when you have the census of the people who are traveling from Babylon to back to Israel, back to Judah, in several lists, it talks about the Netaim. There are so many hundred Netaim who are with them. Well, who are the Netaim? According to the International Standard Bible Encyclopedia, the Netaim were slaves who served under the Levites in the temple. They were prisoners of war who had been assigned to service in the temple as their servitude. And that article goes on to quote Roland Devaux, a French Old Testament scholar. This is Devaux's comment. One may thus assume that the Netaim were originally foreign slaves, mostly prisoners of war, who were given to the temple and assigned the lower menial duties there. Such was the custom among many ancient peoples, the closest parallel being the Sirkutu of Babylon. So that seems to be what Paul, what David is talking about in the psalm, that he's bringing these captives of war back to the temple to give them to God as Netaim, gifts to serve in the temple. Okay, what does that have to do with Ephesians? So let's go back to Ephesians. Now to each one of us, for verse 7, paragraph 18:1, now to each one of us grace has been given in correspondence to the measure of the Messiah's gift to God. Hence it reads, when he ascended to the heights, He led captive a mass of captives, and he gave gifts consisting of men. Now this, he ascended, what does it suggest, if not that, in fact, he first descended into the lower parts of the land? The one who descended, the same one is also the one who ascended high above all the skies to the end that he might fill the all. Okay. Now, to each one of us, grace has been given in correspondence to the measure of the Messiah's gift. Now, I should add that for years, every Bible teacher around me had steered me toward thinking that these paragraphs were about spiritual gifts. So immediately, if you get focused on we're talking about spiritual gifts, you're going to read everything and hear differently. This is not talking about spiritual gifts, not directly at all. In fact, only very indirectly. The grace that has been given us is the grace of salvation. Well, what does it mean that each one of us, grace has been given in correspondence to the measure of the Messiah's gift to God? Well, what he means by that is grace is being given to us by what criteria? Am I one of the Messiah's gifts being given to God? Yes, then grace is given to me. I am given the grace to believe, to be sanctified, and show all the signs of being a member of the people of God. The Spirit of God works in my life, gives me God's grace working in my life to sanctify me, to show that I belong to the eternal people of God in direct proportion, in a one-to-one correspondence between that group and the group that the Messiah is giving to God as gifts. So you follow? Now to each one of us, grace has been given, each one of us corresponding to the measure of the Messiah's gift. And we know from the psalm that he quotes immediately after that, the Messiah's gift is the gift that the Messiah is giving to God. Okay, so in correspondence to the measure of the Messiah's gift to God, he's giving us grace. All right, so far so good. Hence it reads, now why does he say hence it reads? Well, is there a gift from the Messiah to God? Well, that's why the psalm talks about a gift of the Messiah to God. So he's quoting the passage to simply underscore the fact that there is such a thing, that that's a meaningful concept of the Messiah giving a gift to God. Hence it reads, when he ascended to the heights, and as I suggested when we were looking at the psalm, I think that's the Davidic king, the messianic king. When he, the Messiah, ascended to the heights, he led captive a mass of captives, and he gave gifts consisting of men. So yes, there's a gift from the Messiah to God. Now he adds parenthetically, now this he ascended, what does it suggest, if not that in fact he first descended into the lower parts of the land? Now I've already explained what I think he meant by he ascended, but Paul is just parenthetically cluing us in to what does it mean he ascended to the heights? Well, obviously, if he ascended to the heights, he must have gone down from the heights first. He descended. Now, in the psalm, what does that mean? You went down to the plains where you fought your battles against the enemy. You went to war. And you went down to the lower parts of the land of Israel. You went down into the lower parts of the land of Israel, and you did battle. And you came out victorious and you took captives, and those captives you led back up to Jerusalem to give them as gifts to God. So what does he ascended suggest? Well, that first he descended. Now what's the significance of descending then? You went down away from Jerusalem with a purpose in mind. And that purpose included, it may not have been exhausted by this, but it included taking captives that you were going to bring back to serve in the temple. By analogy then, he wants to make an analogy with Jesus. The one who descended. So who is the one that descended in a way that's relevant to us and in a way that's eternally relevant? Well, it's the one who ascended. The one who ascended on high. And there he's thinking of the ascension in the normal way that we think about that. Jesus, who ascended into the heavens, high above all the skies, he's the one who corresponds to the king in Psalm 68 who descended in order to take captivity captives. So who's the one who descended? The same one is also the one who ascended high above all the skies. And why did he ascend, or what's the significance of him ascending above all the skies? What results from that? That he might fill the all. We've seen him use that language before, where this group that you and I belong to, one of the titles he uses for that is the all, or the whole, if you will, or the everybody, or the everyone. What's the relationship between the ascension and filling the all? As Paul puts it, Jesus was raised again for our forgiveness. That is, Jesus' resurrection and obviously subsequent ascension was absolutely essential, was absolutely necessary in order for you and I to get forgiven and granted eternal life at all. So we become members of this group of the everyone, of the all, by virtue of the fact that Jesus not only was crucified, but he was raised from the dead and ascended. So by ascending, he is filling the all with those that he has taken captive while he was here. Okay, let me pause for any questions you might have at this point.
Thank you, Jack. Mm-hmm. Could you explain a little more how you decided in 4 verses 9 and 10 why heavens and earthly regions there didn't correspond to Gentiles and Jews?
I'm sorry, why it respond?
Why it didn't correspond to Gentiles and Jews in the way that we've seen earlier in Ephesians?
It's not exactly the same phrase. It's not those under the skies and those on the land. It's true, he's talking about skies and land, but it's a different syntax and using them in a different context and in a different way. And besides, I don't know how I would make sense out of it as Jews and Gentiles here, because he seems to be explicating the psalm and trying to help us understand what relevance does the psalm have to our situation. And I don't know if I've been clear, but I think what he sees is an exact analogy. Just as the king left the palace, went down to go to war, was victorious, took captives, and brought them back to be servants of God, so Jesus came into history, took captives, and is leading those captives back to be, or is leading those captives to serve God.
Okay, so he's not making the point that the captives consist of both Jews and Gentiles. He's making a different point.
Not here, I don't think
okay.
so.
Okay, yeah. Thank you.
Yeah.
In 4:10 in the New American Standard, that he might fill all things, and you've got that he might fill the all. Is that the thing you talked about earlier about where sometimes the word they translate things is it's a neuter noun, so it could be things or people?
Yeah, yeah. And the specific phrase, ta panta, he seems to be using it as a technical term on a number of occasions here in Ephesians. And I've just translated that the all. But the reason they say all things is because it's neuter, and they haven't concluded, as I have, that pas, this particular adjective in the neuter plural, is often used to refer to people, as in the Galatians passage I cited, rather than things.
And then in the 13, it says, to the measure of the stature which belongs to the fullness of Christ. And you've got, I don't know where you are on that
one. The pleroma.
Pleroma. Okay, is that similar to the problem in the letters of John where he talks about the love of God is not in you, but it's actually in the genitive, meaning possessive, meaning it's either God's love or love for God. Is that the same kind of problem you're running into here? Okay.
No, not exactly. I mean, it's the same in the sense that what exactly do you do with the genitive? That's the problem, yeah. But it's not a question of whether it's an objective or a subjective genitive, as it is in the love of God.
So it's not a question of the fullness of Christ's or Christ's fullness, if that's not the thing you have to deal with in the translation?
Well, if it were a matter of an objective or subjective genitive, it would be whether Christ is filling something or whether Christ is full of something. And that would be blasphemous. So, and you have to decide that. But I don't think this is either an objective or subjective genitive. The pleroma, this is possessive genitive. It's the pleroma that belongs to the Messiah, I think.
That makes a big difference.
Yeah, it does.
I mean, how do you understand that? And you have to, it's you making a decision as to one way or the other based on the argument so far through Ephesians.
That's
it's
right.
Not explicit in the grammar itself.
And as I said, this is the most challenging section in Ephesians because there's so many decisions like that you have to make, and they're all interdependent. They all depend upon each other. So it's a Chinese puzzle kind of thing, and it makes it very difficult.
Well, I mean, it is usually different. Whether I'm reading in New American Standard or I'm reading in your translation. I mean, the implications are...
Did you say it's unusually
it's
different?
It's hugely. It's enormously different.
Uh-huh.
And the implications are pretty big, too.
Yeah, translation matters.
Yeah, thank you.
Paula had a...
So I have a question about 4:10 as well.
Okay.
I'm putting together the analogy between what David did and what Jesus did. So David descended to just lower parts of the land, just elevation, and then ascended back to the temple. But then in 4:10 it says, he who descended is himself, which Jesus. So Jesus descended. Well, I grew up being taught that Jesus descended from heaven
right.
and was incarnated.
Right.
And then he descended into hell to conquer death, because the Apostles' Creed says that, so it must be true. So I've erased all that. So what are you saying? What's the analogy for Jesus descending?
Yeah, good question. When he said, I don't think we can make anything out of the fact that Jesus descended here, because the language is coming out of the psalm describing what the king did. It's not describing what Jesus did. What Jesus did was analogous to what the king did, but it's not what the king did. So he's not saying one way or the other where Jesus came from or the fact that he descended. He's simply saying he played the analogous role of being the victor who took captives and brought those captives back to serve God. I mean, like, notice he didn't even ascend the way the king ascended either. There's no analogy there. The analogy ends with his purpose in coming was to capture individual people that he might turn them over to God as servants of God. And I think that's the full extent of the analogy that he intends. So I think if someone wanted to prove their Christology from here, they'd be misunderstanding what Paul is doing. That this has nothing to say one way or the other about Christology, I don't think.
Thank you.
Hi, Jack. My Greek is really rusty, and I haven't studied this passage at all, but at the end of verse 6, there are a couple of prepositions that you translate really radically differently. You translate dia as to rather than through, and you translate in as for rather than in.
Okay.
Can you, I mean, I those are legitimate translations, but they sure came out of the blue for me.
The dia there I would take to be with respect to, vis-a-vis, in connection with. That is, the question is, he is the God dia all. He is the God in relationship to the all. So yes, it's not your standard first year textbook rendering of dia, but I think I've seen that several times in the New Testament where it has something, meaning something along the lines of vis-a-vis or in relation to or something. So I've shortened in relation to just to two. And the reason I shortened it to two is because what is his claim? He is God to all. That is, I will be your God and you will be my people. To whom is God being God? Us, the all. So it's not, I'm not so much translating it there as I mean, it's a very interpretive translation at that point. The N, likewise, it's not your first year Greek textbook definition of N, but we could go to several passages. There's one noteworthy one in Galatians where he uses in to be a marker for what I call the dative of advantage, or what the textbooks call the dative of advantage. It's who is it that is benefiting or advantaged by whatever it's connected to. So I am understanding it to be he is God to the advantage of all, or to the benefit of all. And how do we say that in English idiomatically? For, I think. So.
Thank you.
What struck me as you were talking is this idea that that we are gifts, basically, that Jesus is bringing back to God, to serve God. Previously, it seems like, and I don't mean just in Ephesians, but in general, my understanding has been that in some ways I thought it was the opposite, that God chooses us to gift to his son because he has been obedient unto death. And so can you just talk about that a little bit?
Exactly right. That both pictures are clearly given. On the one hand, we are gifts that the Messiah is giving to the Father. But turn that around, on the other hand, we are gifts that the Father is giving to the Son. And both are taught, both are expressed, both are true. Yeah.
Jack, could you talk a little bit about slavery? Because we all know that slavery is just about the worst thing ever. And, you know, here we've got David taking slaves and giving them to God. And, you know, we could make an argument that, well, that's just a ancient Near East convention, and, you know, just like polygamy, God let it slide, but he wasn't happy with it. And then you look in the next verse and you got Jesus, you know, giving slaves to God. So you kind of have to deal with that, right? So for those of us that have had it, you know, beaten into us that the worst possible thing that you could do to someone is make a slave out of them. How do you read a passage like this and understand the gift that is being given of human beings that are slaves, et cetera, et cetera.
Okay, wow. Well, on the one hand, to be a slave of God hopefully would strike us very differently than being a slave of another human being. I mean, I don't think that, I mean, there are people, in our society, everything is a problem, but it shouldn't be a problem to us that we would be a slave of God because of who God is. God is God. And I, as a creature, I ought to know that I owe my very existence to him. I owe him nothing but honor, gratitude, service, love, right down the line. So being a slave of God shouldn't be problematic to us. Now, having said that, you're right. If it has been beaten into us, who's the slave here? If it has been beaten into us that slavery is so bad, we're likely going to balk at this. But on the one hand, it is like polygamy. I mean, inherent in the logic of the worldview that is portrayed both in the Old Testament and certainly gets clarified in the New Testament, the very logic of who we are as human beings before God destroys slavery as an institution. It just can't stand up to the truth of what a human being is, on the one hand. On the other hand, it's not the worst of all. I mean, on the one hand, the Bible takes the perspective, you human critters, you're so cotton pick and corrupt. Let me pick the ways to pick on you. I mean, yeah, polygamy, slavery, adultery, this, that, the other thing. You guys are messed up. So let's just get you rightly oriented to me, and we'll clean up all that other stuff in time in the kingdom of heaven. And I think that's what you find in the Old Testament, is it accommodates slavery rather than that kind of huffy self-righteousness, wagging the finger, oh, you do, no, slavery is bad, slavery is evil. Rather, it tries to mitigate the evil of slavery by building into the law, you know, like after 7 years, supposed to let them free, right? Isn't that in there? So it takes the sting out of slavery by, it tries to remove a lot of the evil that there is in the institution of slavery, rather than banning it. So I don't know, is that answering your question?
I think so. I mean, on the one hand, I think that there's a problem with the way that we conceive of ourselves in our autonomy and independence that would see anything akin to this as being, you know, a violation of my very humanity, you know, irrespective of where my humanity came from to begin with, on the one hand. And I think on the other hand, there's something to be said about the fact that when we think about slavery, we always have in our mind the image of somebody who's being coerced into a service against their will, where, you know, everything about them rebels at what's being done to them, and it's only violence and subjugation that keeps them in line, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But it's something very different that's happening with those of us that are being made slaves to God, right?
Okay,
insofar
right.
as,
right.
you know, there is, it's a slavery insofar as I am being made into a person whose will is oriented towards the will of another, but I want that for myself too.
Right, right.
Right?
Yeah, okay, I see what you're saying. Yeah, slavery to God in that regard is very different because how does the Messiah capture me? By capturing my will. by taking control of what I want. I mean, through the Spirit of God, what's changed is what I want, and what I want is to serve God. So yes, I'm a slave, but I'm very much a willing slave. So it doesn't even fall into the category of being coerced against my will into a relationship that I don't want. That's a radical difference.
Yeah, it seems like, you know, people that are going to balk at that, you know, both have to deal with the fact that A, God has that right, and then B, you know, the nature of the slavery is actually one that fulfills and completes you and brings incredible blessing.
Right.
You know, not alienation and suffering and...
Yeah, right on. Exactly.
If I may, in the ancient world, the brutality of war made slavery a welcome option. Having met the enemy on the plains and defeated them, as I understand it, it was common for victors to just kill a bunch of them to make a point after the battle was done. You know, stack up heads. And then they would confiscate their armor and their weapons. You don't want them to have those on the way out. You may or may not give them food for the trip home. But you would just say, we won, you lost, good luck. These guys, as I understand it, they have incurred a debt against Israel because of the lives they have taken and the damage they have caused. Whether they were salting wells or burning stores or tearing down homes on their way in, they're going to stay there and fix that. And they've got 7 years to make it good before they're turned loose. So in one sense, they're on a chain gang. They're working off, they're fixing the, you know, like I said, they're building, they're rebuilding walls, they're replanting orchards, they're sowing fields. In the broader sense, these guys are an example of God's provision in the real world, in the world of conflict and warfare. God won that battle for them. So they are his prisoners, essentially. And David is giving them to God symbolically, saying, they're yours anyway. And I think if I was one of those guys, and I had my choice between hiking home across an arid landscape with no weapons and no armor and whatever food we may have salvaged from our train, I would say, well, I'm going to go work someplace where the law is, if someone punches me and breaks my tooth, they have to set me free. If someone strikes me and damages my eye, they have to set me free. To me, that's a pretty attractive option.
Yeah.
And to work in the temple, you had to be dressed appropriately. So it's not that I wouldn't miss my family, but I knew that when I got dragged out of my country to go to war as probably a conscript anyway. So that form of slavery doesn't seem to really be the thing that trips our trigger when we think of slavery.
Yeah, the ancient world was a very, very, very different world.
Yeah. Anyway.
Yeah, thank you.
Hi. I'm looking at the last phrase of the quote that he gives of the psalm. And he gave gifts in the plural and then the phrase in the dative. Can you walk me through how you're taking the dative?
Yeah, the dative can sometimes be used to describe the content of something. And that's the way I'm taking it here. Gifts that consisted of men rather than them being the recipients of the gifts. That's what the gifts consisted of. And that's one rarer but possible use of the dative.
Okay, thanks.
Okay. All right, we don't have time to make it through the rest of the next paragraph, but let me just orient you to the next paragraph, and then we'll look at it next week. Let me read it. Now, on the one hand, he gave apostles, and on the other hand, he gave prophets and evangelists and pastor teachers for the readying of the sanctified ones for the work of serving God. So notice in paragraph 18, who are we? We are a group of captives taken captive by the Messiah and given to God to serve him. Who are the apostles, prophets, evangelists, and pastors, teachers? Among those people that were given to God as captives, he gave apostles, he gave prophets, evangelists, pastors, teachers. And why? That they might be used to prepare the rest of us to serve God. That's what we're for. That's why we were given as gifts to him, to serve him. So we need to be equipped or made ready or prepared to serve him. And that's what the pastor, teachers, evangelists, prophets, and apostles do. He gave such individuals to the end that the body of the Messiah might be established. They are to serve until we all obtain the one and only one true belief, even the one and only true knowledge of the Son of God, the goal being that it become a full-grown man, speaking with reference to the measure of the height of the pleroma of the Messiah. Okay, there's a lot in there we need to unpack, but essentially what he's arguing is, and in order to understand this, we have to put ourselves in Paul's shoes. That's what we rarely do when we're reading this passage. Paul is an apostle. He's still in the first generation of this thing, right? Paul had a vision of the risen Jesus. Paul took his marching orders from Jesus. What Paul is calling the body, think of it in terms of, right, you remember that scene where Jesus is walking through Jericho and Zacchaeus has to climb up on a tree to see him, right, because there's so many people that he can't get at him. So imagine what that looked like from a satellite. Here's Jesus walking down the road, swarmed by this mass of people around him. Jesus is the queen bee, and we are all the worker bees swarming around him. That's the body of the Messiah, one way of thinking about the body of the Messiah. Well, it's easy to think of that if Jesus is present, right? If Jesus is present and walking down the road, you have all these people gathered, and they're all wanting to see him, to relate to him, to be somewhere in relationship to him. But what if he's not here any longer? What Paul is describing is what God has had in mind from the very beginning. This project that he has is going to outlive Jesus' life on the earth in history. Jesus is going to ascend, is going to get out of here, is going to be gone. But does that mean God's project comes to an end? Can there no longer be a swarm of people who are looking to their head, Jesus, if Jesus isn't around? Well, no, there can be. But how can there be? Because the body itself needs to make contact with others outside of the swarm and invite them to join, invite them to be a part of it. And that's fundamentally, in these next two paragraphs, what he's going to be saying. He will say in paragraph in 20, in relation to him, the whole body causes the growth of the body, right? The whole body causes the growth of the body. We'll have to look at how that happens. We'll see what he says about that. But the point that he's making is God is so acting in accomplishing his purposes that the body takes on kind of a life of its own. And although the head is in absentia, is no longer here, is no longer around, we still relate to the head, but others that we're asking to join us can't relate to the head directly in the way that the initial disciples did. You and I can't relate to Jesus directly the way they did, but we can be taught to know him, follow him, serve him, have a knowledge of the Son of God, anyway by the body itself teaching us. And that's how the body becomes self-growing, self-increasing. And that's what these next two paragraphs are going to be all about. And so how does that fit into his argument? If the first exhortation was, honor the oneness that you're calling, that you've been called to, this is a more complex picture. Recognize what God's project is and honor the project of God in the way that you conduct yourself. Well, how do we honor that? We try to make contact with people outside of the body and join them to the body. I think that's so. Now that I understand what Paul is saying here, this is absolutely the most important passage encouraging evangelism in the entire New Testament. I mean, it's just phenomenal how direct and how explicit Paul is being, I think, once we understand it. So how should we live? We should realize that the ultimate eternal purpose of God is to grow this body of captives. So our job is to go out and convince other people to be captured too, and that they might join the body. We'll take this up next week.